When you think work, you think boots. You think boots, you think Ariat. You think grit, concrete, rain, and heat. And boots that never back down from any of it. You think comfort and durability that hold up on the job, off the clock, and every step in between. Because the day doesn't end when the job does. And from overtime to off-duty, you're thinking Ariat boots. Boots that show up, stand out, and always back you up. Now, it's time to stop thinking and start shopping. Find yours at Ariat.com or a retailer near you.
Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 p.m. on Love Sport Radio.
This is Love Sport.
Upfront on Love Sport with James Gray. Just to run you through that PFA Team of the Year, if you haven't heard it already, Edison in goal, defenders are Trent Alexander-Arnold, Aymeric Laporte, Virgil van Dijk and Andrew Robertson, the midfield three, Fernandinho, Bernardo Silva, Paul Pogba, and then up front, Sadio Mane, Sergio Aguero and Raheem Sterling. Not a bad little lineup, I think you'll agree. There is one Manchester United player in there, which I think is one more than there should be in there, frankly, because United have been terrible. I actually think, when you look at it, this might be the worst Manchester United team ever. This is 12 consecutive games now for Manchester United without a clean sheet. This is a side who've previously prided themselves on being ruthless, on being a great attacking side, but also being a very good defensive side. They've conceded 50 goals now in the Premier League. That's their worst ever defensive top-flight season since the late 1970s. And the season's not even over. They might break a record. This might be the worst offensive Manchester United team ever. I think it's the worst team all over the pitch, frankly. Before the game last night, they were 13-2. 13-2 in a two-horse race. That's like being 500-1. It's absolutely insane. This is the worst Manchester United team ever because they've never been 13-2 to win at Old Trafford. No bookie has ever looked at United and thought they were any worse than they were last night. And they proved it. They were completely and utterly outplayed by City. I thought they did all right in the first half. They held them off in a way that you'd expect most teams to play against City. But it just told in the end. Let's hear from Roy Keane. He was a pundit on Sky Sports coverage of the Manchester derby last night. He says that Ole must be embarrassed by his players.
I don't fault for this carry on that is going to be a brilliant reaction from these players. These are the same players that threw Mourinho under the bus, and they will do exactly the same to Ollie. Leopards don't change their spots. There's too many bluffers at this club to get United back to the very top. You've got to be up for every game at Manchester United, and the fact Ollie's got to discuss it after a game and again the following few days about his players not being up for a game of football, he must be hugely embarrassed.
That's Roy Keane there, who of course will know Ole Gunnar Solskjaer quite well, having played with him at Manchester United during their days, the heydays of Manchester United. He also said he thinks City will be sitting in the dressing room wondering how it was that easy to beat United at Old Trafford, because they didn't really have to work that hard, especially in the second half. They knocked the ball around in a way that you've kind of become used to City. Gary Neville, he says that's everything Manchester United have. They can't do better than that. They're just poor. Graham Souness thinks they're not poor, but they don't work hard enough. You need to be good and work hard to be at the top of the Premier League. And Joe Hart says it doesn't matter what United did, City were never going to panic. It says a lot that there are, in those four people alone, guys who know football inside out and have played at the highest level, there are four different opinions on why United are as bad as they are at the moment. You don't need to work hard to find examples of where United have fallen so far from the great team that Sir Alex Ferguson left behind. It is, of course, made worse by the fact that all those men who made United once great are sitting on the sidelines, watching, groaning, criticising. They're a bit like that parent who wishes he was still playing, trying to live vicariously through his overpressured 8-year-old on a Sunday morning. That's what it reminds me of. You can't deny it's a genuine passion on their part. Although Roy Keane claiming that Fred's inability to track his man was cheating. That's what he said. He said Fred was cheating. That's going a bit far. But I'd love to sit here and say I think the pressure is starting to affect the players. But I can't. Because I think they're oblivious to the standards required of them. There's no idea what playing for a top-level club means anymore. That's how far removed they are from Manchester United of less than a decade ago. all those standards that there used to be at United have slipped hugely. This used to be a club where it was unacceptable to be anything other than all out for your team. It seems that it's not the case anymore. But you probably watched the game last night. There may, though, have been a few things that you missed from the game.
Love Sport.
I'm delighted to say now that we are joined by a man who is in the process of pulling off something quite miraculous. When Wally Downs took over AFC Wimbledon in December, they were second bottom of League One. They were 7 points off safety. And after a brilliant draw against Luton Town on Tuesday, they're now 1 point away from pulling themselves out of the relegation zone. AFC Wimbledon manager Wally Downs is on the line now. Wally, I can't imagine your heart enjoyed that stoppage time equaliser from Steve Seddon on Tuesday.
It's terrific. We had a really unfortunate miss just before that as well. So it wasn't an isolated incident in the second half. You know, they had lots of chances and we camped in half, but we played a couple of good, we had some good possession, circulated the ball, and had a couple of chances ourselves. And I must admit, you know, you're looking at the clock and you know it's ticking. But you know, we were pushing, and human nature had taken over at Luton. You know, they were trying to protect what they had in those last 5 minutes, and you know, it can get a bit edgy, and we capitalised on that.
I know that your goalkeeper had a good game, Aaron Ramsdale, but you must be quite pleased with the fact that your boys were able to play a bit of football with Luton Town, who a lot of people have been talking about like they're going to be comfortable in the Championship next year.
Well, them and Barnsley are the best two sides I've seen so far, and you know, we got our trousers taken down by Barnsley a little bit, but you know, we're a little bit more compact and a little bit more difficult to beat at this stage. So I'm not saying it'll be a problem in a Championship, but certainly when you go from the Championship to the Premiership, when you've been a possession-based side and you go into the Premier League and all of a sudden you don't have the ball for long periods, it can be difficult, as Fulham found out this year. Teams that go up and are a little bit more direct and a little bit more less possession-orientated do better in the Premiership. And the same may apply in the Championship. But I think Luton will fare well, though.
I've been amazed to see Wimbledon's, you know, recovery from what was a bad start to the season, Wally. And I know that you would give credit to the players in this case, but it doesn't seem like a coincidence, your arrival and a lot more points being picked up. Is there much that you've tried to change about the way Wimbledon go about their football in the last 4 months?
Well, the whole thing was because they'd been on a bad run. The whole thing, what needed to do, whatever it was, it had to change. So I'd seen a few of their games, and I just felt that they were making some unnecessary errors too close to their goal. And for me, the most important thing in football is where you lose the ball. If your centre-forward loses it on the edge of their box, they've got 90 yards to run and sort of 9 or 10 players to get past. If you're losing it on the edge of your box, trying to play a little bit too intricately, then you know, there's going to be problems. So it was a little bit ugly the way we first had to go about things, and you know, getting the message across was quite harsh from me. But then after 5 or 6 games, when the penny had dropped a little bit and they realised where we wanted to play, I had to refine it a little bit and say, play some more, because, you know, we'd got a little bit too anxious and we're just aimlessly getting rid of the ball when we could have had a touch and passed and played. And now we seem to have found a balance, and, you know, we're difficult to beat and we're playing some good football.
Wally, you're a man with Wimbledon in your blood, I know that. It must be a little bit of a dream, even to go back in such difficult circumstances in a relegation dogfight. Have you tried to rekindle a little bit of that Wimbledon spirit within the club and hark back to the old days of the team almost?
No, there's no need for that, because, you know, this club was born out of hardship and fight. You know, it's only 17 years old and everything it's had to do has been a fight to get to this stage, you know. So they're creating their own spirit and tapping into that and refocusing that and getting the crowd back on board, because there'd been a bit of a disconnect, was critical. And now, you know, everybody's pulling in the right direction and everybody's together and we're reaping the benefits of it.
Saturday, Wickham. This League One relegation battle, there's about 8 different teams could still go down. Obviously, it's nervy, and I know that you'll be preparing as well as you possibly can, but how confident are you that you're at home to a relegation rival, that the players will rise to the challenge?
Well, all I'm asking for them to do is maintain the standards that they've set for themselves. I ask them to improve. You know, every week we analyse the game and we go through where we can make improvements. But the critical thing is that we don't steer away from what's got us this reasonable success over the last 3 months.
Good luck, Wally. I'm sure they've got Wickham on Saturday at 3 o'clock in what is a massive relegation dogfight. I'm sure Wimbledon will perform as they have. If you started League One on the day Wally took over at AFC Wimbledon, they'd be 13th. That's how many points he's helped them pick up. And actually, it's only because it's so tight down the bottom of League One that they aren't out of the relegation zone already. Just to give you an idea, Gillingham are 13th in League One, 21st is the first place in the relegation zone, and only 6 points separates them. It technically means that anyone in the bottom half of the table could go down. I really hope it's not Wimbledon, because the football that they've played, you know, going to Luton Town, top of the league, high-flying, a side who lost their manager midway through the season because they were doing too well when Nathan Jones went to Stoke. But they've still kept playing well. They're an extremely solid outfit. They play possession football. To go to Kenilworth Road and to go behind twice and to twice peg them back and for Steve Seddon to nod the ball in the 3rd minute of stoppage time, that shows real fight in this team. They're at home on Saturday. They're taking on Wickham, who are 18th, relegation rivals. They've got Bradford on the final day, who are already relegated. So it's not going to be easy, because everyone in those games probably going to give them a hard time. But Wimbledon have got enough spirit. You know, Wally was part of that famous crazy gang at Wimbledon. I wondered whether he had maybe sat them down and showed them a few old VHSs or told them a few stories about what Wimbledon was like in the old days. But it sounds like he doesn't need to. It sounds actually like these players knocked their heads together around Christmas time and went, look lads, this is a special club that's worked very hard to get here. Let's make sure we can keep them there. Wimbledon versus Wickham on Saturday. It'll probably be a sellout, but if you can get a ticket, head down there, because they will be fighting for their lives.
Love Sports.
Yeah, I'm looking back, of course, at last night's football. Arsenal beaten 3-1 by Wolves, but more significantly, United failed to do rivals Liverpool a favour and turn Manchester City over at Old Trafford. They were their longest price ever to win against Man City. Let's speak to someone who's been at Manchester United. Fabian Brandy is on the line. Fabian, were you surprised by how easily City swept United aside last night?
I wouldn't say, you know, I was surprised. I would say, you know, Man City, they're, you know, them and Liverpool, they're in a league of their own. So anyone who's going to come against them, you know, they're going to have a mountain to climb.
But wasn't it disappointing, you know, as someone who's obviously got United in your blood a bit, was it not disappointing to see a lack of fight? You know, that was a Manchester derby and City was so much better, but they didn't even really seem to get challenged by United, physically or otherwise.
Yeah, it's one of them ones again. Man City, there, you know, you got to be very cautious the way you approach them. I know, you know, the few of the lads that are playing there, and they obviously didn't want to lose the game. No one really wants to lose the game, but you've just got to be cautious with Man City, because if you go out to, you know, full on attack, then obviously Man City, if you don't score, then they can literally just pop you off, and before you know it, it's 1-2-3-4-0 down. So I think that's what with the Man United players, they were kind of thinking of, you know, just to be a bit cautious. But towards the end of the game, you know, it would have been nice to, you know, see a bit more fight. But yeah, the lads, they'll be caught up by it, definitely.
Do you think, I saw Ole Gunnar Solskjaer taking them back to the Cliff training ground, a place you obviously know pretty well. I wondered whether that was a move of desperation. He said he was trying to give them a reality check. Do you think that coaches do struggle a bit to remind their players how big these games are?
Not really. I think, you know, at the top level, I think everybody knows how big, you know, certain games are, whether you're playing Man City or whether you're, you know, playing someone at the bottom of the league or you're at the bottom of the league to try and survive. I think everybody knows, you know, everyone's the grown men. So they'll know how big certain games are. And certain managers have got, you know, the ways of trying to inspire players. For example, you just said Ole took him back to the Cliff. That might be Ole's way of, you know, trying to get the players to know kind of the core of Man United and what it's really like. But like I said, every coach is different and every coach has got their ways of inspiring the players.
What is being Man United about? Because obviously you spent, you know, best part of a decade in your tutelage of football there. What is it that's different about that football club in terms of, at least when you were there? Because I think it's changed as a football club, but certainly in the Ferguson era, there must have been a different ethos to the club.
Yeah, when I was there for 13 years under Sir Alex. And it was just, you know, a family-orientated club. As far as, you know, I knew when I was at Man United compared to other clubs, they did things, if you want to say, the United way, where that's just, you know, hard work and grit, and you basically you don't give up till the last minute. That's obviously what when I was at Man United, you know, that's what it was like. Obviously, they've had, you know, change of managers down the years, and obviously football as well. It's a modern football game now, so it's one of them ones where the football's game's changing, and you just got to adapt, really.
Do you think, when you say the game's changing, do you think that someone like Sir Alex, where I assume, right, if that result had happened under Sir Alex, the morning training session or the afternoon training session the day after would have been pretty unpleasant and there would have been some harsh words said. Do you think in the modern game you can't really do that as a manager to modern players?
I think everyone, you know, every player, they're different, and you need to manage players differently. Some players might need a rollicking. Some players might need a ram around them. You know, at the end of the day, footballers, they are human, and, you know, they are, you know, different to one another. But don't get it wrong. Don't get it wrong. Ollie, today, you will be telling the players, like, the performance last night, you know. To be fair, it wasn't a bad performance, but it was just because it was a derby. Mm. Ollie will be kind of letting them know that that's kind of, you know, unacceptable, kind of, in a way, to lose like that. Mm. And to be fair, the players themselves, they'll be cut up. I don't think it will be, you know, a happy camp this morning at United.
Just finally, Paul Pogba named in the PFA Team of the Year, the only non-City Liverpool player, surprised a lot of people. Do you think he's had a better season than we're giving him credit for? And crucially, would you keep him at United this summer if someone came in for him?
I would definitely keep Paul at United. You know, everyone can see what he's capable of. You know, I think since he's arrived at United, I think each season, he's improving. And I think it's just a matter of time before, you know, everyone sees the Paul Pogba that was at Juventus, the Paul Pogba that was growing up at Man United at a young age. I think it's just a matter of time before, you know, people start seeing the Paul Pogba what everybody knows Paul Pogba can do.
Mm. Fabian, thanks so much for taking time out to come speak to us. That's former Manchester United player Fabian Brandy. Of course, he spent years under Sir Alex Ferguson. And I don't doubt that when Fergie was there, if you'd had that 4-0 defeat to Everton and then that defeat to City last night, there wouldn't have been enough electricity for all the hairdryers Fergie would have got out today.
This is Love Sport.
Any regular listeners know boxing's one of my big passions, and one of my personal pet hates in boxing is people pulling out of fights, whether it's because they're injured, because they say they're injured, or worst of all, because they get caught doping. That's what's happened to Jarrell Miller, and we're still waiting to find out who will face Anthony Joshua on June the 1st in New York. Let's talk to someone who might know who it's going to be. Craig Scott, boxing writer, is on the line. Craig, we understand that Luis Ortiz will not be the opponent Joshua is getting on June 1st. Was it a surprise to see him ruled out?
James, I don't think it's a surprise. I think at this point, you know, names are being thrown in the hat. Names are being dragged out of the hat. It seems a little bit unusual, and it seems to me as though they're trying to almost drum up publicity off these higher profile names. Ortiz is the kind of guy now at age 40 who probably needs a slightly longer camp. You know, the money being thrown around, people are talking about $5 million. Is it enough? Is it not enough? I don't think that would bother a man like him, to be honest, especially at this stage in his career. I just don't know if that fight was ever realistic.
I thought Joshua would have... I mean, Ortiz at late notice, you know, he's a southpaw, he's a different fighter from Jarrell Miller in so many ways. I thought it would have been quite a tough fight for Joshua to take late notice, to be honest.
I think if you put Ortiz's name down alongside Jarrell Miller, many people involved in the sport or even in the fringe of the sport would say that Ortiz is a tougher test.
Mm.
You know, he's a Cuban. He's very tricky. Southpaw as well. Even though he's a little bit older, he gave Deontay Wilder absolute nightmares, famously almost stopping him in the seventh round, as you know.
Who are we going to get then? The names at the moment that I've seen, Michael Hunter, who was on the station last week talking up his chances. Andy Ruiz Jr. I've also seen mentioned, which I'm not very impressed by. Which of those do you think is most likely, first of all?
If you, I think if you listen to the bookies at the moment, Andy Ruiz Jr. is the favourite by a decent margin. I spoke to Michael Hunter myself a couple of days ago. Michael is still campaigning for the fight. He's kind of pushed his social media gearing towards the fight, as has Andy as well. But Michael's a very laid-back guy. He knows that it might not happen. I also spoke to Tyrone Spong, who's ranked very highly, higher than both of those guys in the WBO. Mm. And he's of the impression that it might be Ruiz, who could also be seen as a slightly easier touch. But, you know, of either of those two, it's tricky to sort of lambast Joshua because he's been put in that situation through no fault of his own.
But let's face it, let's be realistic about this. Jarrell Miller was never going to be much of a challenge anyway, was it? This was always going to be Joshua knocking someone out in six rounds in front of an American audience for the first time, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I think you'd have to assume that Jarrell would have been stopped. Did he know that was going to happen, and that's why he sort of increased whatever sort of cycle he was on? It seems very, very stupid to be involved in that stuff when the VADA testing is being rolled out throughout the 12 weeks or whatever it was. You know, I think Jarrell just fit the bill. He's from New York. He's probably got a decent following. He'll sell the fight. You saw that sort of farcical pantomime push at the weigh-in. Or not the weigh-in, sorry, the press conference. And I think it just kind of ticked a lot of boxes. But as to whether it would have been a close fight, I don't think it would have been. And I think then you have to consider these potential opponents probably a match with Jarrell Miller in terms of competitiveness, you know.
Look, Craig, obviously you're on the inside of boxing, but for a lot of people and the people who make these guys their money, boxing is a couple of times a year, maybe five or six times a year, they get excited about it. It's quite hard to get excited about the heavyweight division at this moment when you look at what they're all doing. We're desperate to see these guys fight each other, and yet Fury Wilder rematch doesn't look like it's happening. No one's getting in the ring with Joshua. Who knows who Wilder will fight with once he takes on Brazil? It's really frustrating to see, Craig. Are we going to get any closer to the big fights that we want, even this year?
I think you can only cross your fingers and your toes and pray at the end of this year that, you know, maybe we're given one of these big fights. I think if it's going to be any of them, you're probably looking more at a Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder rematch. Mm. I'm obviously, you know, I'm involved in boxing as a writer. I hate politics, but you know, it seems to be Brexit and the heavyweight scenario are throwing up as many confusions as each other at the moment. No one really knows what's happening. Promoters, TV stations are opposing one another. And it seems that all roads are leading other directions, unfortunately.
I mean, I know this sounds like an easy thing to say from the outside, but wouldn't they make a heck of a lot more money if you had Joshua, Wilder and Fury fighting in various different combinations, you know, multiple times for the next 3 years? Or is there too much risk involved that one of them gets knocked on their backside and that's the end of that?
Yeah, I think that's what it boils down to. You know, it's about star power. It's about selling power. I think if Joshua fights Wilder and gets stopped, you know, that derails a lot of people's financial plans. Eddie Hearn, of course, at the moment is coming in for some stick because of the kind of lack of quality for his shows on home soil. You know, if Joshua, the jewel in his crown, is to suffer a defeat, even a stoppage or to lose on points, you know, it really knocks his business model. I think Fury's probably the most likely to step up and fight somebody. He's done it before. He's been put on his back a few times and he's risen up and obviously made a name for himself. His deal with ESPN and his deal with Bob Arum and Top Rank is probably going to make that tougher because they are notoriously hard to deal with.
But if you've just handed Tyson Fury an $80 million cheque, you're not going to want to put him in with someone in his first fight who might actually beat him. That's the problem as far as I can see. Just finally, and this is a story about money again, it seems, Abel Sanchez has split with Gennady Golovkin, one of the better pound-for-pound fighters in the world. Sanchez basically saying he was offered a deal that screwed him over. What do you make of all this?
For me, it's a strange one. It's a strange one, James, especially at this point in Golovkin's career. He's 37 years old now. Obviously, he's just signed a deal with DAZN worth $100 million. I don't really see what he gets other than more money from leaving Abel Sanchez. So it'd be hard to argue with Sanchez's reasoning. You know, at this stage in his career, is he going to learn much more, Golovkin? Is he going to progress much further? Probably not. So it does seem, you know, it does seem to be money-orientated, which is a real shame. because they were one of the great pairings in boxing over the last decade.
Mm. Yeah, and Abel Sanchez, of course, has worked with some great fighters. I understand he's now working with Joe Joyce as well, who could be about to face Daniel Dubois in the British heavyweight title. I was very surprised to see that fight, and we understand it's made, although we haven't had it fully confirmed. I was surprised to see those two men get in the ring with each other, even for the British heavyweight title.
Yeah, I think as we speak, Joe Joyce is being unveiled as a Frank Warren fighter. Mm. So I think they're holding a press conference at the moment to announce that he's signed a deal with Frank Warren and Queensbury Promotions. No longer training with Abel Sanchez, James. So just to give you an update,
thank you very much.
training with Adam Bruce now, which is obviously a booming stable in London. Mm. So he's with the likes of Michael Conlon and Ryan Burnett. So we'll see how that works out. But listen, I'll believe that fight's happening when I see a date and I see a venue confirmed.
Mm. Yeah, it did seem odd to get those two very dangerous men in with each other early in their careers. But Craig, thank you so much for that expert insight. That's Craig Scott, boxing writer. Yes, the Joe Joyce press conference is literally taking place as we speak. He joins Frank Warren's stable. He says that Luis Ortiz is definitely an option. He seems interested. According to Joe, if you can't beat a man 50 years old at Joe's age, Luis Ortiz is 40. Some people claim he's not 40, but he's definitely 40, or at least that's what he says, so we have to believe him. We really hope that Joyce will take on Dubois. We hope that Fury will take on Joshua, that Joshua will take on Wilder, and then we get to see all the great fights, but unfortunately, that's boxing at the moment.
This is Love Sport.
And you will, of course, have heard the name Mo Farah plenty today. You will have heard that he's in a war of words with Haile Gebrselassie, and quite a serious one. It all stems from an alleged theft at a hotel belonging to Gebrselassie in Addis Ababa. Let's talk to the Metro sports reporter, Matt Nash. Covers a lot of athletics and knows this story inside out, I'm sure. Matt, why don't you start off with the facts? What are the things that we know happened? Or, in fact, are there none?
Hiya, James. How are you doing? It's an extraordinary story, isn't it, this one, really? Allegations flying back and forth. And I think it all started with what Mo is saying about having had various things stolen from his hotel. And obviously, Gebrselassie's come back and with counterclaims that Mo allegedly attacked a husband and wife duo. And now the story switched again with Mo saying that he's acting in self-defence. It's been reported that after being attacked by female athlete, the difficulty is finding out exactly where the truth lies in this story, and I think there's more to come out, and allegations are being thrown back and forth, so it's one of those where the truth lies somewhere in between, probably.
Somehow, controversy seems to follow Mo Farah around a little bit lately. I don't quite know how it is, because there was a time, I think probably before he won Sports Personality of the Year, where he was regarded as a little bit dull, a bit of a robot runner, a mobot runner, if you will, and people didn't necessarily like him all that much. Either way, whatever the truth of this matter is, this is not controversy he will have wanted, given that he's running a marathon on Sunday.
Yeah, it's not exactly ideal preparation, is it, with a marathon 3 days away? I don't really know the benefit of bringing all this out just days before the race. As you say, Mo has had controversy in more recent times around him. He's had a fantastic career, 36 now, and you'd think almost, you know, time to head off into the sunset and prepare to do other things. But instead, there seems to be issues like this rearing their head. He could definitely do without this. And I don't think anyone wants to see Britain's greatest athlete and the greatest distance runner of all time really embroiled in something like this. Two guys with fantastic reputations otherwise, fantastic reputations on the track, and now they've got caught up in this very unseemly row. You know, it certainly doesn't do Mo any favours, but perhaps his career on and off the track's got a little more interesting in recent years.
Let's talk about the marathon, because this is, of course, the great thing for Mo to conquer. You know, he's a 2 hour 5 man over 26.2 miles, which is none too shabby. But winning the London Marathon is maybe not the pinnacle, but it would be a massive success for him to do that on Sunday. How committed is he to this? He talked about maybe coming back to the track again. Does that suggest that he's not loving marathon life?
Yeah, 100%. I would say. I think he made that decision to obviously quit the track after London 2017, and it seemed very much like he was closing the door on the track completely. And even I think he said at the time, "I want to be known as Mohamed Farah rather than Mo Farah." It's almost like a completely different guy now to run on the road. It's not really worked out for him. The London Marathon is the one he really wants to crack. He's desperate to do that on Sunday to actually win it. If he doesn't, I can see him coming back to the track quite soon. And there's an Olympics next year, let's not forget. So can't rule out seeing Mo doing the 5 and 10 there. You know, it's not out of the realms of possibility. And, you know, he's obviously got it in his head that he wants to come back round to the track. So I think we will see that in due course, whatever happens on Sunday. But he's got his work cut out against a very strong field on Sunday.
His main challenger will surely be Eliud Kipchoge, a three-time marathon winner, of course, the defending champion as well. He beat Mo last year as he came in third. Mo's going to have to run probably the fastest marathon of his life to win on Sunday. Is he capable of doing it? Might it be a bit of a match race between him and Kipchoge?
Well, yeah, it could well be. And as you say, he's going to have to run the marathon of his life. We're so used to seeing him, you know, he crept up, didn't he, and beat the Kenyans and the Ethiopians over time and kept doing it with those great kicks in the 5 and 10Ks at the major championships. To do that in the marathon, to be able to beat all those talented Kenyans and Ethiopians is an enormous task. And he is capable of doing it, but how much will this row over the last few days with constant statements and allegations back and forth have taken out of him and his preparations? We know his preparations were disrupted slightly anyway by what happened in Ethiopia during his training over there. So has he had the ideal build-up? You know, he looked very rattled this week. He looked very much as if it's taken a bit of a toll on him. It's probably not going to make him have the perfect preparation for Sunday. So, yeah, massive challenge ahead. But to see him do it would be fantastic. And for him, it would be probably the biggest milestone he's cleared.
Just finally, Matt, on Mo's popularity, I mentioned it earlier, he won Sports Personality of the Year when none of us really expected him to. AJ, of course, was supposed to win it that year. Where do you think, since he's left the track, he stands in public opinion, especially with everything that's gone on this week? Is he still an extremely popular figure in Britain?
I think the sense is that he is, but I think there are now questions as to perhaps, you know, what goes on off the track, off the road for Mo now, because he was almost, you know, this perfect golden figure, really, in the eyes of the public. There are certainly question marks over some of that now, because even if these allegations against him, you know, are unfounded, unproven, it's very unseemly. And you definitely don't want Sir Mo, king of the track, our greatest athlete, embroiled in something like this. So it really is not the ideal situation for him. There'll be lots of PR and crisis management going on to save face here and save Mo's reputation, I'm sure. And the whole thing just seems kind of needless. So perhaps his popularity is going to take a bit of a dip as people question exactly who the real Mo is a little bit. You know, is there more stuff to come out in this story? I guess we wait and see.
Yes, you're right, Matt. We will have to wait and see. A lot of allegations flying around between Mo Farah and Haile Gebrselassie. We'll have to leave it there. That's Matt Nash, sports reporter for The Metro, talking about this evolving story involving so many different allegations. Mo will hope that he can do his talking with his feet on Sunday. He's racing in the London Marathon, of course. We'll see him take on world record holder, three-time London Marathon winner, Eliud Kipchoge. We know that Mo's whole career has been taking on the Kenyans and the Ethiopians and beating them at their own game. This is a whole new challenge for him. He's a four-time Olympic champion, but that's 5 and 10,000 metres. This is 42,000 metres.
This is Love Sport.
Now, I've got stand-in producer Mike today, which is bad news for anybody at the best of times, but it's particularly bad news for him because he's an Arsenal fan, and he had to watch last night yet another humiliating result for Arsenal. They were beaten 3-1 by Wolves at Molineux. It's been a good couple of weeks in the West Midlands if you're a football fan, because Aston Villa have won 10 on the bounce as well. Let's speak to James Fielden, who has the pleasure of watching them every week. He's the Aston Villa Football Club club commentator, and he's on the line now. James, I know that you can't remember a run as good as this, because it's a club record, isn't it? 10 wins in a row.
Yeah, I don't think there's any Villa fan, and unless they're well over 100 years old, who can remember any kind of run like this. It's been an extremely long time. The club doing incredibly, given how the middle of the season had gone. And I think they're just relieved, really, that they've managed to get those wins and have managed to secure their playoff place, because now they've played the top two in their last two matches. So the pressure's kind of off, but at the same time, they'll still be quite high-intensity games, I imagine.
For those people who don't watch the Championship a huge amount, what's characterised Aston Villa's style this season?
Well, certainly this winning run has been the return of Jack Grealish. You know, he embodies everything about Aston Villa, very much one of their own. You know, the fans absolutely love him. Carries them up the field, gets stuck in, you know, wins free kicks. He just does everything. They've got loads of experience in the team, as well as young people like Grealish and Tammy Abraham, who's got all the goals. You know, he's on 25 goals for the season now. They're going to be missing him for the last couple of games because of a shoulder injury. But, you know, a mixture of youth energy as well in John McGinn, who they've taken down from Scottish football, who's been a revelation in the Championship. And, you know, some of the older players as well who've, you know, been able to steer them through some tricky times.
You mentioned Jack Grealish there. I almost feel like that incident in the Birmingham game seems to have spurred him on. Look, he's a guy who seems as though he's grown up into a proper professional footballer. But is there any link between this form and that incident? It certainly feels that way.
Well, yeah, possibly. I mean, you know, it was quite nice how that incident happened, and then he went on to go and score the winning goal. I mean, it was all about him in the end. Mm. You know, the Brummy boy scoring in the Brummy derby, you know, he absolutely loved it. And, you know, since then they've gone on and won every game as well, and he's added goals to his game. Villa just been, you know, grinding out the wins, haven't always been spectacular. Certainly in the last couple of games against Millwall and Bolton, they've won without conceding, but haven't been amazing. But, you know, you just got to keep winning the games. And certainly looking at the other teams who are in and around the playoff places at the moment, I wouldn't fancy any of them to beat Villa at all. And it seems like Leeds, who are going to drop out of the top two and go into the playoffs, you know, they seem to be falling away rather than kind of rising. And even the teams who are trying to take sixth place, none of them are really in a particularly good vein of form. And West Brom are kind of just dangling there above them. So it's really in Villa's hands, I see it at the moment.
We'll come on to the playoffs in a moment, but I just want to ask you about Dean Smith, because of course we have a lot of Brentford fans who listen, and I know they were really disappointed to see the back of him, although they could understand why he was there. What sort of impact do you think he's had on the club as a whole?
At the start, it was slow. You know, there have been a number of injuries, players missing, and as I said, they lost Grealish for 7, 8, 9 games, whatever it was. But over time, the likes of Richard O'Kelly have just managed to find them a different dynamic. They're playing in a slightly different way with more energy. As I said, Grealish and McGinn are combined together so well. I think things have just fallen into place, and that's not me saying that Smith hasn't done a great job, because he clearly has, but he's just found a way. He's balanced the team out a little bit more. You know, a few players under Steve Bruce were playing out of position, and he's kind of levelled it up slightly. And Tyrone Mings is the other player I forgot to mention a minute ago. He came on loan from Bournemouth at the start of the year, and he's been absolutely sensational at the back. It'd be really interesting to see if he gets another move next summer, depending on how Villa fare in the rest of the season, because he's been a real rock at centre-back for them. So, yeah, he's put players in their proper positions. He's had fortune with injuries, hasn't been to massively key players, and now they're reaping the rewards from it.
You mentioned going up, and you seem confident that they will go up through the playoffs. If we do get Villa back in the Premier League, how much work is there to do on this squad to make sure it stays in the Premier League? We saw Fulham come up through the playoffs, spend 100 million quid, and then, well, we all know the rest. Will Villa learn from that and maybe stick by the guys who got them up?
Well, they had a new takeover. They had a takeover last summer. Two guys who've come in now who have a big sporting background and you know what it takes to run a big sporting institution. Villa obviously have massive incomes. You know, they're still getting 40,000 every week in the Championship. So, you know, they haven't got problems in terms of finance, but I don't think they'll want to massively revamp it, because, as you say, you run that risk of doing what Fulham have just done. Mm. I think it'd be more a case of what Wolves have done, and make a few astute signings here and there to tinker with the side and improve in a few areas. So, I don't think it would be massive, but I think whoever goes up from the Championship is going to have to add to their squad, because
there hasn't really been an outstanding team for the whole course of the season. You know, teams like Villa have done well in the last 10 games and, you know, other teams have had spells, but there's no one who's really ripped this league apart this year as far as I've seen. So it'll be interesting to see how they do it, but obviously they've still got to win at least two more matches before they can even think about that.
Yes, of course, a small matter of the players. You mentioned Wolves there. I understand you're a Wolves fan. I was going to say you must be in dreamland last night. It's just another routine victory over a poor mid-table side, isn't it?
It was bizarre, but almost normal at the same time. You know, I was talking to Mike before the game yesterday, saying, look, you know, these games are set up. They're made for Wolves. Wolves played out a 0-0 drab draw with Brighton on Saturday, same as Spurs had on Monday, on Tuesday. But, you know, the teams like Arsenal, Manchester United, they have to come to Wolves and play. They can't sit back. They're going for qualifications for various tournaments and competitions, and it plays into Wolves' hands. The only strange thing last night was that the goals that Wolves got weren't necessarily on the breakaway, which is what they've thrived off against the big clubs at home this season. But, amazing goal from Neves. Arsenal architected their own downfall, really, with the two goals they conceded after that. Bernd Leno had an absolute nightmare. And from an Arsenal perspective, really, you know, they've kept six clean sheets in their previous seven games, and then conceded six goals in two games against Palace and Wolves. So it just seems to have suddenly fallen apart for them. But from a Wolves fan point of view, you know, some of the games they've had at Molineux this year, they've beaten Liverpool, they've beaten Manchester United twice, they've beaten Chelsea. Even away from home, they drew at Arsenal, drew at Manchester United, drew at Chelsea. But they're taking on these big teams and giving them more than a good test. And from a Wolves fan's point of view, you're looking to the summer now and seeing what kind of players and clients that Jorge Mendes can unwrap and whether they can take it to the next level.
Well, the next level means not losing to Huddersfield twice in a season.
Well, that's the bizarre thing. I mean, before I came on to you today, I was looking at the wins and defeats that Wolves had had in Huddersfield, because I'm doing the Liverpool-Huddersfield game tomorrow. And Huddersfield have only won three matches and two of them have been against Wolves. they've got to find a way of combating the lesser teams. And I think they're going to have to try and find some more creative spark that can play in the midfield three, because that's what's really turned it around for Wolves this season, the change of formation. And they need that third midfielder, whoever it is who plays ahead of Neves and Moutinho, to unlock and unpick some of the sterner defences, I think.
James, thanks so much for joining us. A real pleasure to have someone with such an in-depth knowledge of all West Midlands football. Actually, that's James Fielden there. He's a club commentator for Aston Villa. He's also a Wolves fan. They, of course, battered Arsenal last night. Absolutely stuffed them, so they did.
Love sports.
And I want to talk a bit about, well, actually, this applies to both of last night's defeated clubs, Manchester United and Arsenal. There was a time when Manchester United and Arsenal losing on the same night in the Premier League would have been absolutely unthinkable. Just not something that ever happened. And yet last night, we almost expected it. We really did. It was just something that was going to happen. City were always going to beat United. And frankly, Arsenal are so poor away from home that there's no surprise when they lose, no matter who it's to. And let's not forget that Wolves are the third best side in the league against top six teams. You don't need to work hard to find examples of where it went wrong for either team, frankly. But the problem is that Manchester United, Arsenal and even Chelsea have been lulled into a false sense of security by the Premier League. When you have the money that those clubs have, and let's not forget that financially, just as Manchester City and Liverpool are, those three clubs are very, very rich indeed. Not only have they got years of massive revenues, stadiums that turn a lot of money over each week, they've also got the Champions League. The money from that, or the Europa League for that matter, every year. They're almost guaranteed European football. Because when you have grown fat on the milk and honey of the European football, it's not hard to roll over and squash the likes of Brighton or Bournemouth on a regular basis. Occasionally, those little wasps of teams will sting you, but realistically, you expect to see them off really easily. And that's the reality of the Premier League these days. The gulf in finances and the quality between the top six and the bottom 14, as I call them, is huge. The top six teams will always, over the course of a season, come out on top. But it's created a bit of complacency, actually, that I think is starting to become evident. To beat those sides, the Uniteds of this world, they don't feel that they have to try and pick up enough points to save them from relegation to seventh place in the Premier League. They don't feel they need to beat each other to actually stay within the top six. They have enough quality. They spend tens of millions of pounds on players that Burnley and the likes can only dream of to ensure that they have enough quality. And that is enough. But if they want to win trophies, to win titles, to compete at the very highest level, they need to do more. Quality alone, simple ability, is not going to win you titles. That was massively clear last night as well. United came up against a side that had the two things that you need to succeed. If you can be overly simplistic about this, there are two things you really need to succeed in football. It's quality and it's work rate. Even Graham Souness, who doesn't always talk sense as a pundit, but on this occasion, give him some credit, I thought he had a point. He said that they are the two things you need, that you have to have the ability and work hard to produce it on a regular basis. City have that. Barcelona have that. Liverpool have that. You could even claim that Tottenham are the kind of side who have that. United, Arsenal, Chelsea do not. Each in their own individual way, those three clubs, who formerly were part of an untouchable Big Four. Now, you remember you used to talk about that, the Big Four. It wasn't the Big Six, it was the Big Four. And it was Liverpool, Manchester United, Chelsea and Arsenal. They were the player. They were the teams who you could expect every season to be dominating the Premier League. It's not the case anymore. I think United, Arsenal and Chelsea have fallen behind the other three in the Big Six. The entire ethos around all of those clubs has allowed the players to stop working hard because they've told them that they're good enough on ability. Take this article on the Chelsea website today, right? Complaining about Eden Hazard not being selected in the PFA Team of the Year. This is a team voted for by the players themselves. So what? Chelsea think that Hazard has done enough to deserve to be in it, even though the very people he's played against don't think he's as good as the teams in the title race. How on earth can they justify saying that? How on earth can they think that it's okay to say of a player, oh no, don't worry mate, you are good, we know you're good. It's pathetic. And the constant sacking of the manager at Chelsea has told the players that they're above the law of the club, that they're above the club itself, and that they don't need to work hard for the boss. So while there are talented players in the Chelsea squad, they don't think they need to work hard. At Arsenal, Arsene Wenger spent the last years of his reign allowing mediocrity to become a standard. We talk about standards at football clubs. Arsene Wenger made mediocrity the norm. They got used to playing poorly, turning up on a Monday morning and going, oh yeah, well, we drew on Saturday, but, you know, at least we passed the ball quite well, or, you know, well, there was that one really nice move and that was good enough. That's what's happened at Arsenal. And so when you go to a team like Wolves, who are right up for a game, who have a good system, a group of decent, talented players, and who are prepared to work extremely hard for a well-drilled manager whom they trust and respect, Arsenal haven't got a chance. And then you come to United, who by fudging the replacement of Sir Alex Ferguson, by removing the backroom staff, and by showing absolutely no ability to plan strategically, have sent the same message to their players. 10 years ago, United, if they were to speak to their players as a club, would have said, this is what Manchester United is, mould yourself to it. Make yourself a Manchester United player. Work hard for the manager and together we will make each other great. What's the message to the players now? We will mould to you. Come here, be the player we know you can be. We'll pay you loads of money and we'll let you express yourself. And then we'll try and make Manchester United fit around you. I'm not saying that's necessarily a wrong way to do it, but the results speak for themselves. At City and Liverpool, the team is bigger than the players. At United, at Arsenal and at Chelsea, the players are bigger than the team. That's the difference. You saw it last night on two separate games in a nutshell. That's the difference between good and great. You want to bridge that gap, you're going to need more than a bridge. You're going to need 5 years to catch up again.
Love Sport.
You've been listening to Upfront with James Gray, the podcast edition. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1 till 3pm on Love Sport Radio. And don't forget to leave us a rating and a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.